Hello, ladies and gentlemen. This is Dan Trotter, Pretty Good Bible Studies. I am now covering Genesis chapter 38, verses 1 through 30, the entire chapter. This is the story of Judah sleeping with his daughter-in-law Tamar. Quite an interesting story. Our context is this. We had just finished up with Joseph getting sold into slavery in chapter 37. And now we take a break from Joseph's story to take a little rabbit trail into Judah's story. We'll talk about why Judah was included here. We start now with Genesis 38, verse 1. And it came about at that time that Judah departed from his brothers and visited a certain Adullamite whose name was Hirah. At that time, it's complicated as to when that might be. There's a complicated debate about it. Basically, two options. When Joseph was sold into slavery, Judah left his family and went over to the Philistine country in the hill country of the Shephelah over there toward the Mediterranean coast southwest of Jerusalem. Or it could be after Jacob's coming to Shechem and when he returned from Haran with Rachel his wife. Remember, he came to the Jabbok River, wrestled with the angel of the Lord, went to from Mahanaim there where he camped over to Succoth, crossed right on the way to the Jordan River, across the Jordan River, and went over to Shechem. And so some people say that's when Judah left. It doesn't really matter. We're going to be agnostic on that question. Judah departed. Now, Judah's sordid story here illustrates the danger the Israelites were facing in Canaan. They resisted assimilation in Egypt pretty well because they were despised. They remained separated, as the NIV Study Bible says. But in Canaan, they weren't slaves. The Jews weren't. They were prosperous. And so it was much more tempting for Canaanites to marry into the prosperous tribe of the Hebrews and thus assimilate the Hebrews. Some people speculate that Judah had left Hebron, where the brothers had gone to quote-unquote console Jacob on the loss of Joseph as they hypocritically joined in the funeral processions there. Again, that's just speculation. We don't know when this story of Judah and Tamar was written. But he departed. He did this voluntarily. And I'm sure at the end of his life he can say, why did I do that? Why did I not stay with the children of Israel? Now, this is remarkable that the Lion of Judah, Jesus, had Judah as his ancestor. Lion of Judah on the throne. Judah. Jesus was of no reputation, as it says in Philemon 2:7. You look at his genealogy. He got Rahab, the prostitute, the probable prostitute in there, and with Tamar, which we'll see in just a minute, is involved in his ancestry. Jesus didn't come from good stock, as they say down here in the South, which I think is a most regrettable part of my Southern culture, to talk about people's good stock. It doesn't mean anything. What matters is a person's individual character, not what family he came from. Now, the fact that Moses even included the story of Judah shacking up as a prostitute who turns out to be his daughter-in-law, the reason Moses even included such a sordid story is he wanted to have an impartial history of the Hebrews, and he gave it, impartial. Warts and all, he told what happened. This was not a hagiography. So Judah visited a certain Adullamite whose name was Hirah. Now, Adullam was a city in the hill country, southwest of Jerusalem, as you go toward the land of the Philistines, which later became known as the land of the Philistines. Not yet, but the Philistines later were to settle there. Adullam became famous later on because David holed up in a cave there. We get to the story of David. We'll talk about David in Adullam. We go down to verses 2 through 5 in Genesis 38. Judah saw there, this is in Adullam, Judah saw there a daughter of a certain Canaanite whose name was Shua. We don't know Judah's wife's name, this daughter of the Canaanite. We know Judah's father-in-law's name, Shua. Judah saw there a daughter of a certain Canaanite whose name was Shua, and he took her and went into her. That means he married her. So she conceived and bore a son, and he named him Ur. So that's Judah's firstborn is named Ur. Then she conceived again and bore a son and named him Onan. She bore still another son and named him Shelah, and it was at Chezib that she bore him. All right, so Judah's now got three sons, Ur, Onan, and Shelah. And these three sons came from a Canaanite. Now, remember, marriage with Canaanites was forbidden by Abraham and Isaac to try to keep the seed unassimilated with the pagan Canaanites. Abraham, for example, specifically told his servant, probably Eliezer was his name, not to get a Canaanite wife for Isaac. Genesis 24:3. Abraham says to his servant, "And I will have you swear by the Lord, God of heaven and God of earth, that you will not take a wife for my son from the daughters of the Canaanites among whom I live." Abraham was worried about assimilation. Abraham's son Isaac specifically told his son Jacob not to marry a Canaanite. This is in Genesis 28, verse 1. So Isaac summoned Jacob, blessed him, and commanded him, "Do not marry a Canaanite girl." If you recall in that story, Rebecca had said that her son Esau's Hittite wives were making her life unlivable. Judith and Basemath, if you remember those two characters, they must have been real pieces of work because Rebecca couldn't stand them. So the patriarchs were very concerned about not marrying the Canaanites. Well, here Judah is going in and married a Canaanite. Jacob had spent his whole life avoiding a marriage to Canaanites. He married late. He married Rachel. He had to go to Haran to get her and work all those 14 years to get her. He could have just married a Canaanite and been done with the whole thing. But no, he's not going to do that. Now, Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown speak of the results of this Canaanite marriage. Quote, "Not surprising that the family which sprang from such an unsuitable connection should be infamous for bold and unblushing wickedness. As we'll see, Ur and Onan were evil, and they died. Now, the firstborn was named Ur. The name means watchman, as John Gill says. It's interesting, Ur and Onan's name actually show up in secular history on Mesopotamian documents, according to the NIV Study Bible. I like to run that one down. Third son, Shelah, his name means tranquil, quiet, peaceful, prosperous. How nice. But he was born in the town Chezib. That town, the name of the town means deceitful, according to Easton's dictionary. Also probably the same name as Achzib, and that word Achzib means falsehood. Mentioned in Micah 1:14, by the way, the houses of Achzib will become a deception. So falsehood, deception, interesting name for a town. I don't know why the city fathers would name their town that. So there's Judah's background. We go to Genesis 38, 6 and 7, verses 6 and 7. Now Judah took a wife for Ur, his firstborn, and her name was Tamar. But Ur, Judah's firstborn, was evil in the sight of the Lord, so the Lord took his life. Now Ur was guilty of some exceedingly wicked sin because he was not only wicked, he was wicked in the sight of the Lord. That phrase there shows that he must have done something really bad, and that's why he died. In fact, if you take the Hebrew letters that spell out Ur in Hebrew and you reverse those letters, you end up with the Hebrew word for wicked, as if to say Ur was thoroughly evil. I don't know if that's a coincidence or not, but that's the truth. Now, Tamar, who was married to Ur, Judah's firstborn, was probably a Canaanite herself. Some people speculate she was a Hebrew. Maybe she was the daughter of Levi, Judah's brother. John Gill mentions a speculation along those lines. We're going to assume she was a Canaanite. Judah's got himself plunged headfirst into Canaanite culture. Ur, the Lord took Ur's life. He either did that immediately and struck him dead or after an illness, probably after an illness. God usually doesn't intervene supernaturally with stuff like that unless it's a special occasion. And I imagine here, unless Ur did something extraordinarily evil, he probably just died from getting sick. We go now to Genesis 38, verses 8 through 10. Then Judah said to Onan, "Go into your brother's wife and perform your duty as a brother-in-law to her." Onan is the second son now, the first surviving son after Ur had died. "Perform your duty as a brother-in-law to Tamar and raise up offspring for your brother. Your brother Ur doesn't have any children. He needs them. So Onan, do your duty. Marry Tamar." Onan knew that the offspring would not be his. So when he went in to his brother's wife, he wasted his seed on the ground. His brother's wife is Tamar. He wasted his seed on the ground in order not to give offspring to his brother. But what he did was displeasing in the sight of the Lord. So he, the Lord, took his, Onan's, life also. Now what's this business? Why did Judah say, "Onan, go into your brother's wife, into Tamar, and perform your duty as a brother-in-law"? Well, that was the custom of levirate marriage. Levir in Latin means brother-in-law. This idea was later codified in the book of Deuteronomy. Deuteronomy verses, chapter 25, verses 5 and 6. "When brothers live together and one of them dies and has no son, the wife of the deceased shall not be married outside the family to a strange man. Her husband's brother shall go into her," in other words, her brother-in-law, "and take her to himself as wife and perform the duty of a husband's brother to her. It shall be that the firstborn whom she bears shall assume the name of his dead brother, so that his name will not be blotted out from Israel." So when the brother-in-law went in, had sex with his sister-in-law, who was now a widow, that son did not belong to the live brother, the brother-in-law. The son belonged to the family of the dead brother to keep the dead brother's tribal name alive. And so the person performing the duty of a Levirate brother-in-law actually was sacrificing. He was having a child that would not be his. And back then, of course, children were of high premium value. Now, later on, this practice of the Levirate brother-in-law extended in the book of Ruth to the idea of a kinsman redeemer. Remember, Boaz was not Ruth's brother-in-law, but he was her nearest kin, and so he married her and performed the duty of a brother-in-law, raising up kin, raising up children for Ruth. So the whole purpose of this Levirate custom was to keep the tribal family name going. Underpopulation was a severe problem back then, and specifically underpopulation of the chosen seed. That was a severe problem all the way through the book of Genesis, it seems like. And remember, the promise of the seed was that the seed would be as the dust of the earth, and here we're having trouble having one or two kids. But at any rate, the brother-in-law's name would be placed for the deceased in the genealogical tables, but the table would show that the deceased brother's family is the family that counts. The brother-in-law's family would not count. So that would explain why Onan did what he did. He wasted his seed on the ground when he went in to have sex with Tamar. It says in verse 9, Onan knew that the offspring would not be his. He knew because he knew Levirate custom. Now, wasting his seed on the ground, that was violating his duty of the Levirate brother-in-law, and that's what he's chastised for. In fact, he's going to die for it. It's a big deal back then. However, almost everybody, it just seems like so many Christian commentators have said the sin of Onan has to do with masturbation. Or some people say it has to do with coitus interruptus, when people have sex with their wife and don't want to have a baby, so they pull out and spill their seed on the ground. Folks, this sin that Onan committed has nothing to do with masturbation, or Onanism, as sometimes it's called. I think coitus interruptus is called Onanism. That has nothing to do with it. Now, I'm going to read you an hilariously funny quote from Adam Clark. Remember, he's writing in the 19th century, and he is saying that this sin of Onan had to do with masturbation, with wag flagging, tickle pickling, muscle tussling, bean creaming, log flogging, pole rolling, etc. Now listen to what he says about it. Quote, on what is generally reputed to be the sin of Onan, something very pointed should be spoken. But who dares and will do it, and in such language that it may neither pollute the ear by describing the evil as it is, nor fail of its effect by a language so refined and so laboriously delicate as to cover the sin which it professes to disclose. That's florid 19th century language saying that, hey, I need to tell you what this sin is, but if I describe it too closely, it's going to offend your virgin ears. But if I euphemize too much, then you won't understand what I'm talking about. That's what Adam Clark is wrestling with here. He continues, elaborate treatises on the subject will never be read by those who need them most, and anonymous pamphlets are not likely to be regarded. The sin of self-pollution, that's masturbation, which is generally considered to be that of Onan, is one of the most destructive evils ever practiced by fallen man. In many respects, it is several degrees worse than common whoredom, and has in its train more awful consequences. Though practiced by numbers who would shudder at the thought of criminal connections with a prostitute, it excites the powers of nature to undue action and produces violent secretions which necessarily and speedily exhaust the vital principle and energy. Hence the muscles become flaccid and feeble. The tone and natural action of the nerves relax and impeded. The understanding confused, the memory oblivious, the judgment perverted, the will indeterminate and wholly without energy to resist. The eyes appear languishing and without expression, and the countenance vacant. The appetite ceases, for the stomach is incapable of performing its proper office. Nutrition fails, tremors, fears, and terrors are generated, and thus the wretched victim drags out a most miserable existence, till, superannuated even before he had time to arrive at man's estate, with a mind often debilitated even to a state of idiotism, his worthless body tumbles into the grave, and his guilty soul, guilty of self-murder, is hurried into the awful presence of its judge. Now, folks, you ever read that to your teenage boy? That'll cure him. Somebody needs to read that to James Dobson. And James Dobson said that if to relieve the extra backup of semen, you're talking about men now, not women, that masturbation was all right as long as you didn't, as long as you didn't fantasize when you were doing it. I wonder what he would think if he ever read this quote by Adam Clark. I don't know if he has, but that's the quote. In fact, of all the audios I'll ever do, from Genesis to Revelation, this has got to be the best quote I've ever read. This quotation rivals what James Joyce said about hell in The Portrait of Art of an Artist as a Young Man. He described hell in such a way that, by golly, you don't ever want to go there. It beats anything I've ever seen in the Bible, even. Well, at any rate, interesting rabbit trail there, but Onan violated the Levirate custom, the Levirate law of raising up children for his brother, his deceased brother. And as a result, what he did was displeasing in the sight of the Lord, verse 10, Genesis 38. So the Lord took Onan's life. Again, that could either be with an immediate striking death, but most probably from a fatal sickness. We go down to verse 11, Genesis 38. Then Judah said to his daughter-in-law Tamar, "Remain a widow in your father's house until my son Shelah grows up." For he thought, "I'm afraid that he too may die like his brothers." So Tamar went and lived in her father's house. Now, this is basically an expulsion of Tamar from Judah's house. For whatever reason, Judah was not happy with Tamar. He could have just let her stay in his house. And in fact, if he'd have done so, he wouldn't have done what he accidentally did later, which was sexually sin with her, as we'll see in just a minute. Now, Judah said that, "I'm afraid that he too may die like his brothers." Apparently, he thought Tamar was some kind of a jinx. John Gill says Tamar was a jinx, in his opinion. Well, I don't know about that. I don't think so. Those brothers didn't die because of Tamar. They died because of their own sins. But apparently Judah thought she was a jinx, and so he probably had no intention of marrying his son Shelah. He just told her, "Well, you just wait a little while till Shelah grows up. Meanwhile, stay in your father's house." He was trying to get rid of her, trying to get the jinx out of his house. The NIV Study Bible says that Judah had no intention of marrying his son Shelah to Tamar. I don't know if that's true or not, but I wouldn't be surprised if it were true. Genesis 38, verses 12 through 14. Now, after a considerable time, Shua's daughter, the wife of Judah, died. Shua was the Canaanite who had a daughter, unnamed daughter, who married Judah. She died. And so now Judah is a widower. And when the time of mourning was ended, Judah went up to his sheep shearers at Timnah, he and his friend Hur the Adullamite. It was told to Tamar, "Behold, your father-in-law is going up to Timnah to shear his sheep." So she removed her widow's garments and covered herself with a veil and wrapped herself and sat in the gateway of Enaim, that's a town on the way to Timnah, which is on the road to Timnah, for she saw that Shelah had grown up and she had not been given to him, and he and she, Tamar, had not been given to Shelah, to him as a wife. Now, the exact location of Timnah is not exactly known. According to the NIV Study Bible, it's somewhere in the hill country of Judah. Joshua mentions Timnah. Joshua 15, verse 48, in the hill country, and then Joshua lists some towns in the hill country. That's the country southwest of Jerusalem towards the Mediterranean, where the Philistines later ended up. Joshua 15:57 actually mentions Timnah. Judah was probably participating in the annual sheep shearing festival. He went up there with his buddy Hira. Distinguished Hiram, who was from Sidon, I think it was. Either Tyre or Sidon. I can't remember where Hiram was from. That was later on in the times of David and Solomon. This is Hira, a friend of Judah, and they both went up to the festival at Timnah. And on the way, they went through a little place called Enaim, and there was Tamar sitting by the side of the road, all veiled up. Now, if Judah had been an honorable man, he would have passed on by, but no, he has to get a little. His wife's died now. He doesn't have any outlets. Can't control his lust. And so he hires her as a prostitute. Now, Tamar was wearing a veil. This was not to advertise herself as a harlot. All women wore veils back then in public. But it did have the nice purpose of hiding her identity from Judah, which of course is important. If he had recognized Tamar, he never would have hired her as a prostitute. She was sitting by the road, and this was a customary position for prostitutes to take, sitting by the roadside. We see this in Jeremiah 3:2. "Lift up your eyes to the bare heights and see, where have you not been violated? By the roads you have sat for them. By the roads you have sat for them, like an Arab in the desert. And you have polluted the land with your harlotry." So the harlot sat by the roads. Now the reason she did this is stated right here in verse 14. "For because she saw that Shelah had grown up and she had not been given to him as a wife." So she's thinking, I'm never going to have a kid. My father-in-law, Judah, is a lying son of a gun. He said I could marry Sheila, and Sheila's grown up, and he hasn't come to get me out of my father's house. So she's either trying to take revenge on Judah, but I think her main motive is not really to take revenge on Judah, but to get that son. Because by golly, these Jewish women, they wanted a son more than anything, more than their sexual purity. Remember Lot's daughters sleeping with their own father because they didn't have a son? My gosh, the desire. I mean, all women desire to have babies. That's sort of an innate biological drive even to this day. But back then, it was an obsession to have a kid. So she's gonna pull this prostitute stunt, which is immoral. It's not, she knew that she was but not only selling her body, Tamar knew that she was selling her body to her father-in-law. She knew that she was committing incest. Genesis 38, verses 15 and 16, we continue. When Judah saw Tamar, he thought she was a harlot, for she had covered her face. So he turned aside to her by the road and said, "Here now, let me come into you." For he did not know that she was his daughter-in-law. And she said, "What will you give me that you may come into me?" The John's haggling with the prostitute. Why did Judah think she was a prostitute? Because she was by the side of the road, and she was sitting by the side of the road, as I said. That's how everybody knew who a prostitute was back then. Now it says, he thought she was a harlot because she had covered her face. Now, it would be easy to interpret this as because she wore a veil, Judah knew she was a prostitute, but that can't be because all women wore veils back then. That wouldn't signify that she was a prostitute. What it means is he thought she was a harlot because she was sitting by the side of the road, and he thought she was a harlot and not Tamar, for she had covered her face. So the purpose of covering the face, the fact that it was mentioned here that Tamar had covered her face, was to show why Judah did not recognize her as his daughter-in-law, as Tamar. Now, his ignorance of who Tamar was at least excuses Judah from the crime of incest, because of crime, you know, you have to have intent, and he didn't intend to commit incest. So he wasn't guilty of the crime of incest, but he was guilty of prostitution. Genesis 38, verses 17 through 19, he, Judah, said, "Therefore, I will send you a young goat from the flock." That's his price. She's worth the price of a young goat. I don't know how much goats were worth back then, but it seems to me it's not a very high price for the privilege of having sex with someone. She said, "Moreover, will you give a pledge until you send it?" He said, "What pledge shall I give you?" And she said, "Your seal and your cord and your staff that is in your hand." So he gave them to her and went into her, and she conceived by him. Then she arose and departed and removed her veil and put on her widow's garments. Now she wanted a pledge. She wanted proof of paternity in case she conceived. Remember, that's what she's hoping. She's hoping to have a baby. And she wants to prove who the father was. I mean, if she couldn't prove that, she's just as good as a prostitute. She wanted to be included in the genealogy. Now, ostensibly to Judah, the pledge was to ensure that Judah delivered the goat. But Tamar wasn't interested in a goat. She was interested in having a child, and she wanted to prove whose child it was. Now, what was the pledge? Seal and cord. The seal was probably a small cylinder seal, which was rolled over clay documents in order to sign a document. This is according to the Ivy Study Bible. The cord, according to that same study Bible, was a cord that ran lengthwise through the cylinder, and because there's a hole drilled through the middle of the cylinder, and then the cord was tied around the owner's neck so he could keep up with it. Now, why did Tamar ask for a staff? Because she wanted double security. In case the seal should be lost, she'll have a staff. So Judah goes into Tamar. Now, of course, that's not by the side of the road. Of course, they had a tent somewhere they went into that Tamar have, and then Tamar conceived. Now, of course, she didn't know that she conceived immediately. She would have to wait a month or so until a period didn't show up. But she got what she wanted. She got that wanted child. She gave up her virtue in order to get that child. You know, some things aren't worth the price. And then she departed. She took off her prostitute's clothes, whatever they were. She put on her widow's garments so no one would know she had played the prostitute, and she disappeared. Now, she did that so that whoever was going to return with the price, the young goat, would not be able to find her. If that had happened, if she had taken the young goat, she would have to give back the seal, the cord, and the staff, and she would have no proof of paternity of whose baby that was. So she ran so that she could keep that seal, cord, and staff. We go now to Genesis 38, verses 20 through 22. When Judah sent the young goat by his friend the Adullamite, that's Hira, to receive the pledge from the woman's hand, he, Hira, did not find her. He asked the men of her place, saying, "Where is the temple prostitute who was by the road in Anaim?" Anaim, remembers the city where the prostitution occurred. But they said, the men of Anaim said, "There has been no temple prostitute here." So he returned to Judah and said, "I did not find her." And furthermore, the men of the place said, there has been no temple prostitute here. Now notice that now she's not just a prostitute, she's a temple prostitute. That's because there's a different Hebrew word used here than in verse 15, where Tamar was first described as a prostitute. Here, Hira asked for a temple prostitute, different Hebrew word. Judah's friend perhaps used this term because it was more acceptable, because temple prostitutes had a higher social status than ordinary prostitutes. Well, the response was negative. There are no temple prostitutes here. She sat there such a small time so as not to have been observed by anyone. Tamar is a smart cookie. Genesis 38, verse 23, then Judah said, let her keep them. Otherwise, Judah is saying this back to Hira when Hira comes back to Judah and says, hey, I couldn't find her. Judah said, let her keep them. Otherwise, we will become a laughingstock. After all, I sent this young goat, but you did not find her. Now, why is Judah afraid of becoming a laughingstock? Because Judah's fornication would become known should Hira keep looking for the prostitute. Hira's going around and said, you seen this woman that my master Judah hired to be his prostitute? Actually, he wouldn't say that, but people would ask, well, why do you keep looking for this particular prostitute? And Hira would have to say, because my master Judah's trying to pay her. Well, that would make Judah look like a John, a whoremonger. So Judah doesn't want to look like a laughingstock, so he just said, forget it. And after all, I don't need to keep looking for her because I sent the young goat. You didn't find her. It's her fault, not mine. I did my best to pay her. So Judah didn't want to be a laughingstock because even heathens look down on people who went to prostitutes, even today. Oh, really? You're having sex with a prostitute, right? Gee, what is that? You got a disease? How much did you pay her? Oh, my gosh. Are you such a pitiful person you can't even get somebody to have sex with you without having to pay for it? Also, he'd become a laughingstock because he was tricked by a whore. The whore ended up with his cord and seal and a staff. He's lost his seal. That's a big deal for people back then. Worth much more than a young goat, I would think. And he would have to admit that he dragged his friend Hira into the whole Hira prostitute scheme, and that would make Hira look bad. So no, Judah says, we're just going to let it go. We go to Genesis 38, verse 24. And that was about 3 months later that Judah was informed, your daughter-in-law Tamar has played the harlot, and behold, she is also with child by harlotry. Then Judah said, bring her out and let her be burned. 3 months later, that was enough time for people to see that Tamar was pregnant, and they started asking questions. The pregnancy was reported to Judah, and he says, let her be burned. Now, burning later in the law, 400 years or so, well, several hundred years later in the law, burning was the legal penalty for prostitution, at least for the daughter of a priest. We see that in Leviticus 21:9. Also, the daughter of any priest, if she profanes herself by harlotry, she profanes her father, she shall be burned with fire. So, burning with fire is the worst way to be executed. Oh my gosh, painful, horrible. John Calvin tried to get the elders of Geneva to not burn Civitas by fire because that was such a horrible way to die. Now, when Judah said let her be burned, he probably meant take her to the magistrates and let them pronounce a sentence of burning, as John Gill says. And, of course, the sentence was to be carried out after she delivered the child. It would have been considered barbaric to burn a pregnant woman, of course. Now, the interesting thing is Judah really had no legal authority to have her burnt. He's living in Adullam now, but you would think that city elders would have that authority, and Judah was not a magistrate, as far as we know. Adam Clark and Jameson Fawcett Brown do point out, however, that as patriarch, he exercised judicial functions, but I say, patriarch, really? Patriarch of what? He had no children. Ur and Onan are dead. Sheila has not been married yet, so he's patriarch over Sheila and his ex-daughter-in-law, who he's kicked out of a house and sent back to her father's house. Why can he say, hey, let her be burned. Maybe that's up to her father. Tamar wasn't even in his house anymore. Well, whatever. His authority may or may not have been, he wanted her burned. Adam Clark says that Tamar had actually committed an act of adultery, not harlotry, because she was betrothed to Sheila. So you could say that the burning was punishment for adultery, not prostitution. To me, that's a technical distinction. Doesn't make any difference. The point is she was sexually immoral and was subject to, legally, she was subject to some kind of punishment. Now, Judah wanted her out of the way, and this is the way to do it. She had disgraced the family. He didn't want Sheila to marry Tamar, probably, because he thought she was a jinx. And he had already probably publicly promised that Sheila was to marry Tamar. He had already promised, at least privately, to Tamar that Sheila was to marry her, and he hadn't carried out his promise. And he's thinking to himself, well, now I can get rid of that jinx. We just have her burnt as a prostitute. And now I don't have to worry about Sheila marrying him as I promised. He probably thought she was a jinx, remember, because his first two sons, Ur and Onan, had died after marrying her. So we go now to Genesis 38, verses 25 and 26. It was while she was being brought out that she sent to her father-in-law, saying, I am with child by the man to whom these things belong. And she said, Please examine and see whose signet ring and cords and staff are these. Judah recognized them and said, She is more righteous than I, inasmuch as I did not give her to my son Shelah, and he did not have relations with her again. In verse 25, she was being brought out where? To the place of trial from her father's house. Then she sent a messenger. She probably said, Hold on, I need some evidence here. I need to send a messenger to Judah, my father-in-law. Now, verse 25 says, She said, Please examine and see whose signet ring, etc. are these. It was probably not her directly, but by the messenger, the words were conveyed. And she, through her messenger, said, Please examine and see whose signet ring and cords and staff are these. So she did, and of course, she presented the pledge, the cord, the seal, and the staff, and Judah recognized, oops, Tamar is the one I got pregnant. And that must have been quite a shock to his system. His sins had found him out. And she said, She is more righteous than I. Now, what did he mean? More sexually righteous? I don't think so. I mean, actually, Tamar was the more guilty party, the guiltier party. She deliberately and knowingly entered into incest. Judah did not. He just thought he was going to have a little fun with a prostitute. But Tamar knew she was having incest. And her motive was not lust, but to have a child. So that motivates her sin, ameliorates her sin a little bit. But nonetheless, she committed incest. Whatever her motives were, she committed incest. So how can Judah say that she's more righteous than him? Not sexually. By the way, this story shows that people who take sex lightly, like it's a handshake, and oh, I got a different partner, I'll try some different technique with my new partner. The way these idiotic, sexually immoral millennials do on their podcast. They don't understand life. They don't understand that sex is serious, that it has serious consequences. It always does, not just back then. If you don't believe me, watch Lifetime movies. Almost every disaster, every personal disaster and tragedy that happens in those movies is because of a sexual sin. And these girls think they're going to be sugar daddies so they can make a little bit of money. I was raised up in church, but then I needed the money. I need a Louis Vuitton handbag. And so I looked in an ad, found an escort service, and found some old elderly businessman who was lonely and he wanted to talk with me. Next thing I know, I'm giving my body to him and he's paid me $500. Ah, well, you know, I'm not going to call that prostitution. That's being an escort. No, I can just do that and it's no big deal. And then later on, they look at themselves and they say, I'm a worthless piece of trash, a baggage. God doesn't love me. No man will ever love me. No, sex has consequences. People who want to be happy for the rest of their life will stay virginal until they meet their lifelong spouse and stay faithful to that spouse until the day they die. That's the way, folks, that you can avoid tragedy due to sexual immorality. Well, why did Judah say that Tamar was more righteous? Not sexually. Had nothing to do with that. But what he meant was is that he had not acted properly as a father-in-law. He had promised Shelah to Tamar to marry Tamar, and he reneged on that promise. He was not planning to carry out that promise. And note that Tamar had held herself back from marriage to wait for Shelah. She was not married. So she was definitely harmed by Judah's actions. And so Judah realized he had sinned here. Now some incidental notes before we leave this verse, these verses. It appears that Shelah never did marry Tamar. Now, I don't know what commentator, but I think it was John Gill that said that. He said that probably because Tamar had committed incest with Judah, with Shelah's father Judah, and Shelah didn't want to marry somebody who had shacked up with his father, and I can understand that. Gill says that apparently Shelah had children by another woman, and he quotes Numbers 26:20, the sons of Judah, according to their families, were of Shelah, the family of the Shelahites. So Shelah had kids. He was included in the genealogies. But that verse in Numbers 26:20 doesn't show that Shelah married another woman besides Tamar. It could have been Tamar who married Shelah and had the Shelahites. So I don't know what happened to her. I'm curious, but I don't know. I know that I would imagine it would be difficult to marry somebody who had seduced your own father-in-law with a trick like that and who was playing the prostitute. Now we should take note that in verse 26, Judah did the honorable thing and he no longer had relations with Tamar again. Thank God. Genesis 38, verses 27 through 30, and we continue. it came about at the time she was giving birth, so that would be about 6 months later, that behold, there were twins in her womb. Moreover, it took place while she was giving birth. One put out a hand, and the midwife took and tied a scarlet thread on his hand, saying, this one came out first. But it came about as he drew back his hand that, behold, his brother came out. Then she said, what a breach you have made for yourself. That was to the brother that came out. So he, that brother who came out ahead of the baby with a scarlet thread on his wrist, that baby that came out was named Perez. Afterward, his brother came out, who had the scarlet thread on his hand, and he was named Zerah. Now, at the time there were twins in her womb that would be discovered by the midwife before the birth of either. I'm like Butterfly McQueen, Prissy on Gone with the Wind. I don't know nothing about birthing babies, Miss Scarlet, and I don't. But I'm assuming that a midwife would know that they're twins in the womb. That's not surprising. And so the midwife would then think, oh, now we're going to have a problem. Who's going to be the firstborn? Because the firstborn has the right of primogeniture, and so it's very important to know that. And so when one of those babies stuck out his hand, the midwife put a scarlet thread on his hand. This one came out first, to show that this one came out first. And what's not said in the text, but which is implied, is that midwife is concerned about who's going to get the inheritance, so she put the scarlet thread on the hand. Now I have a question here. Why does sticking the hand out qualify for being firstborn? I would think the whole baby would have to be born to qualify. And if the whole baby has to be born in order to be the firstborn, well, that would make the scarlet ribbon superfluous. Unless the midwife is thinking, well, this baby has stuck his hand out, so he's probably going to come out first. And when both the babies come out, we could easily get them mixed up. After all, they're twins. So I'm going to put a scarlet ribbon around his hand so that after the babies are delivered, we'll know which one's first. Now, that makes sense. So the scarlet ribbon wouldn't be superfluous. Well, as it turns out, Perez pushed himself past Zerah. And so Zerah, even though he had his hand stuck out first, wasn't delivered first. And so Perez was the firstborn. And he would have the right of the firstborn primogeniture. Now, Adam Clark's got an interesting speculation here. He said, Perez is usually reckoned in the genealogical tables before Zerah. And from Perez, not Zerah, does the line of our Lord proceed. And then Clark says, probably the two brothers, as being twins, were conjoined in the privileges belonging to the birthright. I don't think so. I don't know where Clark gets that idea to me. Seems to me like Perez was considered the firstborn, especially when you look at the genealogical tables, and Perez is usually reckoned before Zerah, as Clark rightly said. So we're going to assume that Perez is the firstborn, receives the right of the birthright according to the laws of primogeniture, and so he was in the direct line of Jesus when you look in the genealogies later on. Now, when Perez came out instead of Zerah with the scarlet thread around Zerah's wrist, when Perez came out instead, the midwife said, whoa, what a breach you have made for yourself. She's astonished that the birth order would be reversed like this. She expected Zerah with a scarlet cord to come out first. And when she said, what a breach you have made, does that mean that Perez was a breach birth in the sense that he came out bottom first? I don't think so. I think it means that he pushed his way out ahead of Zerah, and so she said, what a breach you've made. And by the way, Perez means breach, or breaking out, as the NIV Study Bible translates it, breaking out. Now, Perez became the head of a leading clan in Judah, as the NIV Study Bible says. He became the ancestor of David. We see this in Ruth 4, 18 through 22. Now, these are the generations of Perez. To Perez was born Hezron, and to Hezron was born Ram, and to Ram, Amminadab, and to Amminadab was born Nashon, and to Nashon, Salmon, and to Salmon was born Boaz. That's Ruth's husband, Boaz, and to Boaz, Obed, and to Obed was born Jesse, and to Jesse was born David. So Perez is in the direct line of King David, and of course David was the direct ancestor of Jesus, so Perez is the ancestor of Jesus. One more example of how the unexpected person ends up being in the genealogy, not the firstborn. Cain and Abel, Abel is favored. Esau and Jacob, Jacob is favored over Esau, the younger. The younger is preferred to the older. This story might not fit that so well because it's not really clear who was the younger and the older. Now, why is this story of Judah and Tamar even included in Genesis? Which is an interesting question. Well, it's probably because of the genealogy. The author wanted to show the promised seed, the line, the offspring promise that was made to Abraham in Genesis 12 and repeated in many places thereafter. And so here's the offspring. This is how it happened. That's the reason. It's not just because it's an interesting story. All right, so Zerah comes out next with a scarlet cord around his hand. What does Zerah mean? NIV Study Bible translates the name as scarlet or brightness, so that would be obvious as to why. Adam Clark translates Zerah as risen or sprung up. I don't know why risen or sprung up would apply to Zerah's birth so much. I think scarlet or brightness works much better. But let's look at that. Scarlet works because of the scarlet thread around his wrist, so that means that a translation of Zerah as scarlet makes sense, as the NIV Study Bible says. Adam Clark says risen or sprung up. Well, that could be because Zerah would have risen like the sun, but for Perez's beating him out. Well, that's a stretch. We'll just take it to mean scarlet because of the scarlet thread around his wrist. And with that, we have finished with Genesis chapter 38. Judah sleeps with daughter-in-law Tamar. That prepares us for the next chapter. We return to the story of Joseph. In chapter 39, we'll do the whole 23 verses of that chapter and discuss the story of Joseph and Potiphar's wife, who tried to seduce him. We'll see you next audio. Hope you enjoyed this one.